You think you're so goddamn high and mighty just because you're a goddamn lighthouse keeper? Well, you ain't a captain of no ship, and you never was. You ain't no general. You ain't no copper. You ain't the president, and you ain't my father. And I'm sick of you acting like you is. Sick of you laughing, snoring, and your goddamn farts. Your goddamn...
Hey guys, welcome back to the Blood and Black Rum podcast. I'm Ryan from coldsploitation.com, and I'm joined with my co-host, Martin.
How's it going?
Oh, we're doing pretty well. We're back again, and we had talked about what we were going to do for the show the last episode, and we stuck to it this time. We stuck to our guns. Proud of us. And,
denied.
Yeah. And I'm surprised to, like, I'm a little bit upset that we didn't do The Witch first, but you know what? It's okay. We'll get to it at some point, because you haven't seen The Witch.
No, and it's been on my Netflix, so for like 5 years
now. Been on the to-watch pile. Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit upset that we didn't do that, because I think, you know, that would have been another fun one to talk about. I wonder what you think about that one, but... And it's been a while. I've actually only seen it once, and it's been a long time since I've seen it. I saw it in theaters with my family, and I was telling you previously, as you're talking about this movie that we're going to cover, when I saw it with my parents in theaters, we were watching the movie, and, you know, it has a very specific New England dialect, you know, from the time period. My parents were sitting there, and they're like, can't understand a goddamn word they're saying. can't understand anything.
Needs nice subtitles at the bottom so you can,
yeah,
follow along.
New England dialect subtitles. We're not going to do that one. We'll do it at some point, of course. But the one that we are doing is another Robert Eggers movie. And he's only had a few. He's only had The Witch, this one, and his most recent one, The Northman. And he's working on, apparently, a rendition of Nosferatu as well. Nosferatu. Which I think will be cool, because he does period pieces very well. And he's been kind of all over the map. So I think Nosferatu will be a really cool one to see from him. Have you seen the original Nosferatu?
Yes.
It's a great movie. Great, great movie. I remember watching it. It's a Halloween night. I was really bummed because I did not make it home from college for Halloween. So I was in my, you know, like any normal person, any normal college student in their dorm room on Halloween night, not going out partying and stuff, but just sitting in the dorm room moping because I wasn't at trick-or-treat. Any normal college kid. And I watched Nosferatu that night and had a great experience watching it. It's very, very moody, very, you know, Set the tone right for Halloween night. So I'm interested to see what he does with Nosferatu. Be pretty cool. But we're not here to talk about Nosferatu. We're not here to talk about The Witch. We're talking about The Lighthouse from 2019, which also surprised me quite a bit to see that The Lighthouse released in 2019. I felt like it was last year. I was like, oh, yeah, like it just came out. A year, maybe two ago. No, it's fucking 4 years old now. And I'm just getting to it. I feel bad. It was all the rage at the time, too. How did we miss it? Even our friend. It's not really in his wheelhouse at all, besides the fact that it's nautical. He saw it. So I feel very left out. So, your first Robert Eggers experience, right?
Yeah.
You didn't see The Northman. I didn't see that one either. Haven't seen it. I have it, but I haven't seen it. Not our first Willem Dafoe experience, and certainly one that's right up his alley in terms of character. And we covered Antichrist on our...
almost a year ago.
Yeah, yeah. On our... What was that? What did we call that?
You called it...
Disturbed films?
Difficult films.
Difficult films. That's right. Difficult films. Yeah.
Very catchy.
yeah. That one was a... You know, that was a definitely an interesting role for him. And The Lighthouse is another really interesting, defining role for him, I think, and one that he embodies. You know, it's a great portrayal of what he can do for like a serious role like this with a dialect and language. Does a great job. And then you got Robert Pattinson as well. And this, the cast is really only two people for most of the movie. You got Robert Pattinson, and I think a lot of people were thinking, hey, Robert Pattinson, Twilight guy?
No, he's Batman now.
Well, yeah, now he is, but at the time, he was like, the Twilight guy? What's he going to do in this movie? And he's impressive. Does a really great job. Which I think, again, it's kind of unfortunate that some of the Twilight people kind of got railroaded into typecasting or people that expected things of them that weren't really true. You know, Kristen Stewart has gone on to have a pretty good career as well outside of Twilight and prestigious movies. And Robert Pattinson, you know, does the same here with The White House. What do you think about the 4:3 aspect ratio, black and white, chiaroscuro in The White House? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's I think it's a great aesthetic and it works here. You know, I definitely would have a hard time imagining the film, especially now after seeing it, being in a different, you know, in color.
Mm.
You know, getting to see the world in color.
Mm-hmm.
I think that black and white style does, you know, and that aspect ratio that it's shot in definitely lends to a, you know, classic, you know, classic style of cinema that, you know, I was thinking Ingmar Bergman, like, which I haven't even really seen any of his films, but I've, you know, seen shots of like his exteriors and stuff. And yeah, they look kind of, you know, very similar. I think thought it was a pretty good touch and aesthetic and was really wonderful to watch.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it works really well. Again, it, you know, it has shades of being influenced by lots of those, you know, films of the 1930s, the, you know, the very classic black and white look to them, classic settings, very beautiful island setting as well, apparently shot provincially in Canada. I don't know exactly which province it is. Maybe Prince Edward Island?
Nova Scotia.
Oh, is it Nova Scotia? Okay. Because my friend Michael had just said, he asked me how I felt about the beauty of his neighbor land there. And then I think it's really ironic, too, because in the movie they keep mentioning Canady in North, the North. Canady. They shot it there. So, no, but it's really beautiful. I think, you know, you're right in some sense, you know, it kind of has elements of Bergman. I also think, you know, and this is not to say that, you know, he did it first or anything like that, but occasionally this movie does have elements of Wes Anderson too. You know, I don't know if that's inspiration or just both pulling from the same sources of inspiration, but it does have a lot of the like similar shots and similar aesthetic setups and the scenes that I, you know, kind of reminded me of a Wes Anderson movie, especially, you know, his later output. There's a great shot of Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson waiting to like enter the lighthouse. They just got there. It's like at the beginning of the movie. And they just are facing the camera, looking quite miserable. They've had a nice miserable trip over on a rocky boat. And now they're waiting for a 4-week stint in the lighthouse. They're just staring at the camera, looking nice and miserable. It's a great shot. We're going to forego doing any of the transitions because some people have said they don't like them. So,
you hit that button. It's a great transition.
I wish I had the foghorn sound set up on the soundboard here, but I don't, alas. So, let's just go ahead and talk about the beer that we got on show today. Do you want me to go or do you want to go? How do you want to handle this?
You've just been kind of rip roaring here.
So I know. We've just been kind of moving through, so. I don't want to take away from you.
No, it's fine.
Yeah.
No, I guess I'll set it. No, you know what? No, you set it up because you're the one that got this, so.
Okay. All right.
Set it up.
Well, I saw online that one of our breweries that we've had once maybe on the show, once or twice. They were putting out a new set of beers, and they were calling it the Space Case because they were doing it for Space Exploration Week. And so I was like, you know, we don't get them a whole lot. We do get certain things from them, but not like a whole lot of things. Like we don't get every single release around here because they're not super local. So I decided, you know what, I want to order this Space Case. It looks pretty interesting. It's got a interesting amount of beers in it, and it came with like 24 in the case, which Martin and I split between us. So because it was rather expensive to order, so we each got 12, and we decided we wanted to cover one of them for the show. So we picked one that was probably the most interesting, or one of the most interesting out of the bunch. And this one is from Equilibrium Brewing, and it's Astronomical Twilight, which is a SIPA or a SIPA, which I, you know, haven't really heard referred to a whole lot with a SIPA. And what I have seen referred to as SIPA is more like Session IPA. But in this case, they're meaning Sour IPA. And it's brewed with watermelon, strawberry, lime, and it just says select hops. So, Astronomical Twilight, Sour IPA, what do you think?
Well, you fucking ruined it for me. It's not good, Bob. Not good. It's not what you want. I haven't had a lot of Equilibrium. I've had, you know, a bit. Usually the stuff they do well is really well, but I'm starting to find that the stuff that's not good, it's not good. And to be honest with you, this, I'm going to take a sip. My health. It's a mess. So the idea is nice. A sour IPA. We've had a couple. You know, they're not that rare, especially seeing as everyone's doing everything as fruity as possible with IPAs. And I like the idea of it because watermelon's not something you see in an IPA. You know, neither strawberry. You do see lime. You know, kind of. But you know, it's. Then totally different fruit profiles for IPAs because, you know, the Naipas go for more tropical, your guavas, your star fruit, your, you know, kiwi, you know, mango, etc. It's such a conflicting mess because you do get that watermelon, and my mileage is totally going to vary on it because I do like watermelon. I don't like fake watermelon, though. It's too sweet. It's like artificial banana. Too sweet. Doesn't have that right taste to it. So you got that there. And then the strawberry does kind of pair well with it, but it's not like a fruity strawberry taste. It's like a candied strawberry taste, like the strawberry you get from your grandmother's house. It's got those hard strawberry candies with the crappy jelly in it that, you know, are disgusting and terrible. The lime is there. Very mild, though. And it does give it, like, a kind of a goes tequila, margaritas, like, kind of flavor to it, because it adds, like, a little saltiness to it that kind of wraps that up. But because the strawberry's not that good, the watermelon's not that good, and then you can't taste any IPA out of this. It tastes just like a sour, like a goes, basically. But not only that, just like, I can't remember if we did for the podcast or not. I don't think we did. I think we just had it. When they did their version of the Neon Zoom Scorpion Bowl, which shout out to our Fightin's Mule for getting us that, which theirs was the worst version of that because a bunch of different breweries did it. And it was terrible. It had a tinny, overly yeasty, kind of spoiled taste to it that just lingers in the front and lingers on the back and just lingers and lingers and lingers. That's all you really taste out of it. And goddamn, if this thing doesn't have that same issue. And I kind of blame Ryan for ruining this probably even more than it should be, because originally I was like, what is that goddamn weird taste? And he's like, huh, kind of like that Neon Zoom Scorpion Bowl that they did. And it unlocked repressed memories of that beer, and
yeah, I'm sorry.
It's, but I mean, when drinking, I spent fucking $65 on a 12-pack. But
well, not all of this beer,
not all of them. But I mean, yes. Still though, this is just what the hell? Beer balanced by science, my ass.
Just not balanced enough for you. Yeah, I mean, I agree. This is definitely not my favorite of the Equilibrium beers that I've had, including the Scorpion Bowl. The Scorpion Zoom Bowl, I think, was probably the worst that I've had, for sure. I don't really enjoy that one. I thought that one was quite bad, honestly. This one is better, at least to me. It still has a funkiness to it that I don't really appreciate. And like you said, too, it doesn't really have an IPA quality to it that you would be looking for when, you know, when it's called sour IPA. I think the biggest issue is that there's a culmination of too many flavors here. You get watermelon, and that watermelon is really upfront and funky. And I think that's one of the biggest issues is that watermelon flavor combined with like the strawberry and lemon. I think if you just had the strawberry and lemon, it probably would have been okay, or if you just had like watermelon, it might have been okay. But I think the combination of all three of those is kind of going too far, and it gives it that funkiness to it that I just don't really think works that well. And I would have liked to have seen a bit more IPA nature from it too, more hop element to it than what we get, because I think that that's kind of lacking. So again, I don't think it's awful, but I do think that I was expecting more from it, and it's not the best beer that I've had from Equilibrium, and certainly not up to the quality that, you know, I kind of was expecting. But, you know, an interesting experiment. I'm interested to see what they do with the other one, the sour IPA that we have too. It's like I think it has cherry in it. I'm interested to see if that is something different than this one. Like maybe it's better. Hopefully it's better, you know, and hopefully it's not a return to form like this one. Because if that's the case, then I'm probably going to skip out on all Equilibrium sours, because that would be like a 3-for-3 strikeout there. And that's, you know, it's my limit. No more sours from them, because
they just don't do it right.
Right. They've you know, and it is kind of telling that, you know, their Scorpion Zoom Bowl, made from basically the same recipe, because it was on a Zoom call with like a bunch of other breweries, is the lowest rated, and by far the lowest rated, like not, you know, half a star or something. It's like a whole, like 2 stars rated less than like the Mortalis one and the Vitamin C one. So It is kind of telling. They don't do sours that well. So we'll see, though. We'll see, you know, if they can do a little bit better on the other one that we have in this pack. Is that good enough for you, Beer Mule? Is that a good enough review? Shout out to the Beer Mule.
It's really, really good.
That's all you need to say.
It's really, really good.
All right. Back to the Lighthouse. Where to start? Where to start? Since I talked quite a bit, do you have a place that you want to start? You want something specific that you want to talk about right away?
Great setting. Great
New England coastline, yes. Supposedly.
With Willem Dafoe just being like batshit. Really engrossed in the role. It makes me almost think like he went up to like Portland, Maine for like 6 months and like sat with some like a family that, you know, were from Mariners their entire life and was like, I'm going to become these people. I'm going to learn how they talked and know all their nautical terms. By the end, he was like skipping out like, you know, like an old prospector, but the New England version. Delightful.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said in the beginning, Willem Dafoe does a great job. He really embodies the role. He looks the part, sounds the part. He just hits it out of the park here. You know, you couldn't really ask for a better person to fulfill this role. I can't think of one. Can you? Can you think of somebody who would better suit the role of this, you know, this guy who's a hardened sailor who has had to kind of put that life away? You know, the film kind of makes it known like he had a wife and a kid and that didn't go so hot. And then, you know, he's become this lighthouse keeper who basically hoards the lighthouse to himself, you know, the actual beacon area of the lighthouse, hoards it to himself, won't let anybody up there. He has a fucking key that a padlock and a key, and he locks himself in after. He just embodies it, and it kind of harkens me back to like the Life Aquatic 2. Like, what if we were to replace, you know, Willem Dafoe in the Life Aquatic? yeah, Bill Murray in that one. It would be interesting, you know. It kind of brings me back to that.
I'm forgetting him. Oh my god! No, I'm just laughing.
The thought life was.
Yeah, was bitched.
Yeah.
Fine. I'll go home. Why? What's wrong? You didn't pick me.
And I also, yeah, that's what I wanted to preface this show with, too, is the Lighthouse is basically the behind the scenes of the Blood and Black Rum podcast. It's how we act before every episode, you know? Martin's the cantankerous one. I'm the more quiet and reserved one. And then we get together. Eventually, we have drinking parties. We have dancing parties.
Oh, we drink.
We have pissing parties.
Say we have Navy rum, you know, the nice British sailor standard Navy rum.
I love we love getting down to sea shanties.
Keeps the scurvy away.
That's what we do in Blood and Black Rum podcast. And then we get on the show and then we try to settle it down a bit, tone it down. Yeah, so I think there's a lot going on in the Lighthouse, which actually is kind of ironic considering the fact that it is an hour and 50 minutes of two guys in a lighthouse. From the outset, you're kind of thinking, what the fuck is going to go on in this movie? You have a limited location. You have two characters that pretty much are the only people on screen for the majority of the film. And what are you going to do with that hour and 50 minutes? And I think that's what's one of the things that's so striking about The Lighthouse is that Robert Eggers manages a whole hell of a lot in this very limited scope. You know, it's a very engaging film, despite the fact that, especially early on, not a whole lot happens. And that's partially because of the direction and the setup of, you know, the setting and everything like that. But it's also
it's essentially like a stage play brought to film.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
You know, it's very, you know, the scope itself of the setting and who's involved in it is very small, very kept in.
I think, yeah, if you wanted to do it for stage, I think you really could. The only changes you really need to make is with set design. You have to limit the scope just a little bit. There are obviously things in this movie that make it a movie, but you could limit that and you could accomplish that in much more simplified means for a stage. It would be kind of, I think there could be some intrepid people out there who'd be like, I want to put this on for my high school play. Let's do the light. It's for the high school play. And if you do, I want to see that. Send us a link to the live stream performance of it, because that would be... Say you got the idea from Blood and Micron Podcast. I'm sure your t-shirt will be happy.
Wouldn't that... You know what? What would be better than that? Tim and Eric do the Lighthouse stage play.
Yeah. That'd be great. But, like, I mean, to be honest with you, I do think it could succeed as a stage play. It is almost like a one-act play, but drawn out to three acts. But it's also due to the fact that Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe are really good, and they are both characters that you are drawn to. Willem Dafoe, for his obvious cantankerousness and the way that he kind of switches off between two different types of personalities. You know, he's very gruff in the day, and at night, after he's been drinking a bit, he's a very pleasant guy to hang out with. You know, he's dancing and, you know, putting on sea shanties, giving you nice tales of sailor talk and things like that. You know, he has like a striking change when the daytime and between the daytime and nighttime. And then Robert Pattinson, fucking smoking like a chimney, making it look real damn cool, honestly. You know, not that I think smoking in general is cool, but in this movie, he does make it look appealing because he's just fucking constantly up on the ladder hauling a bunch of shingles, smoking.
I like, too, that they got him actually rolling his own cigarettes, too.
Yeah.
Because, they weren't real, like, good cigarette machines that weren't coming around until, like, the 1920s. So they're keeping it accurate that if it was to be smoking cigarettes, he'd be sitting there rolling his own.
Yep. You know, but it definitely makes it look a little bit appealing, you know. And I think he does a really good job. Like, he's got a great mustache, the hardened visage that he has is really good. Like the way that he puts it on, especially like with the chiaroscuro of the lighting, you know, it kind of molds to his face a little bit. They really get it to be shadowed in ways that really set up like the suspensefulness of it, because that's a really big part of this movie too. Not a lot happens early on in the movie where you're like, this is a horror movie or something like that. You're just, you know, it could for all intents and purposes be like a fucking 1930s jaunty Abbott and Costello thing of like two unlike guys are at this lighthouse just doing stuff, and this one guy's just being a lazy asshole making the other guy do all the work around. Could be, you know, could have been that. Instead you get tentacle monsters and mermaids and things like that, sirens. But I think that like the chiaroscuro does a lot, and the setup of all of the suspenseful stings too is really great. Like it just really sets a very uneasy feeling throughout the movie, and you're not really sure why. Like, did you get that feeling at the beginning? Like you're kind of like, I'm feeling a little uneasy here. There's tension, but you're kind of in the back of your head. You're like, I'm not really sure what's going on to make that feel tense or why we should be feeling tense. I think that's an interesting feeling.
Yeah, I think the fact too that like that drone is like omnipresent throughout the film for the most part up until like the end of just gives like it gives the forebodingness of like, you know, what's going on. Even in the quiet moments, it's always there. It's always, you know, kind of just going on. And, you know, and he kind of like the volume of it's queued up, like, you know, like sometimes like it's very muted, but it's still ever present. You can still hear it in the background, like the, as you know, like Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson, and they're like having a, you know, their supper, and you just hear the background like, you know, just constantly going, and it kind of goes with the flow of like the tension of what's supposed to be brought out in the scenes.
And you have the whole idea too, like that's set up pretty early on, that we have Willem Dafoe's previous lighthouse partner went crazy. Fucking
allegedly.
Yeah. Went crazy. He heard the foghorn too much and fucking just lost it. And
he heard the call of the siren and went out and went batty.
Yeah. So you kind of have that in the back of your mind too. And then I think the other thing that does a really great job, or that Robert Eggers does as a really great job, is these inclusions of very off-kilter scenes that you're not really expecting. Like, you're not... The film kind of plays out, and for a lot of time, it's, you know, probably the first 30 minutes or so, it's kind of a montage of, like, Robert Pattinson taking shit from Willem Dafoe, constantly getting belittled.
I was going to say, literally taking shit, throwing chamber pots out.
Mm-hmm. Throwing chamber pots out, like, doing all this mundane... but very physical work throughout, while Willem Dafoe just basically sits up in the top of the lighthouse. And, you know, you're kind of feeling for Robert Pattinson. And then, so it's just kind of sets up this like montage of stuff that he's doing. And then all of a sudden, you kind of get these weird inclusions of different shots and scenes that seem out of place. There's that one really great early scene where Robert Pattinson's going out to the edge of the water, and he's seeing like this guy in the water. And all these like little, it looks like timber or barges that are like kind of floating away from him, like he just got crushed by it. And then he finds the mermaid, and it's a really great shot that comes out of nowhere. It just is like, you know, all of a sudden you just experience it. And I think that works really well. And that he kind of continually uses that motif throughout. That all of a sudden there's just like this change in the way that you're, you know, the flow of the movie, where it just immediately snaps to a different perspective of like suspense. And obviously I think that's intentional, especially considering the themes of the movie.
And for the love of God, it's not a goddamn mermaid. It's a siren.
I mean, they call it a mermaid and it's listed as a mermaid in the credits. Mm-hmm.
It's a siren.
You're right. I mean, it's a siren in
Greek
mythology. Yeah.
I would say, Geralt of Rivia doesn't go around killing mermaids. He kills harpies and sirens.
Shriek of the mermaid is really good, too, or the siren. Very piercing. Like, especially that first moment where you see the mermaid and he's like, oh, she's so beautiful. She's, like, covered in barnacles, looking at her titties. And then all of a sudden, she just starts shrieking. It's a really good moment.
And it's just so funny to think of, like, you know, well, how do we come up with the idea of a siren and harpy? Well, you've been at sea for 7 months, and then you're about to wander to shore, and as you're getting closer, you see a woman. Well, she's got, you know, scales for legs, but you're like, well, fuck it anyway.
I'm just gonna go for it anyway.
I've been at sea for so long, I don't really even care.
Yep. What do you think about I guess we should just get into it. What do you think about the themes of this movie? Like, I know there's a lot of people that either like or don't like The Lighthouse. And I feel like, unfortunately, a lot of that hinges on the fact that people come away from it thinking, well, I didn't understand it, so fuck it. I didn't really like it, right? Like, I didn't grasp the entirety or the enormity of what the themes are trying to tell me. And so I didn't like it because of that. What do you think about that and, you know, the themes that are presented to us in the movie?
I think it's not even really necessarily the themes of the film that are going to be turning off to people if you don't like the film. I think the premise itself and the setup, the fact that, again, it's kind of advertised as a horror film, but it's not a horror film. At least in my eyes, I wouldn't call this a horror film. It's like a psychological character study and thriller. And it's just about two people. And again, the way it's kind of presented is kind of like a you know, a little play. So I think your mileage is totally going to vary with how engrossed you are in the performances of Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe, and how engrossed you are into the setting and what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because the film, as we were talking about before we even got to discussing it on the podcast, it's got a billion different ideas, and some of them good, some of them bad. And you can totally, it's an incredibly open-ended film on the themes and what you're supposed to kind of glean from it. And I think that's kind of the fun, too, because it's so open-ended and you can draw your own conclusions on what you think's really going on in the film, you know? And I think that also is going to lend itself, this film, to be an easy film to rewatch and kind of, you know, see, watch, you know, look for things that you didn't notice in, you know, previous viewings. But I don't even think necessarily, like I said, like, I don't even think the themes, the billion different themes that are kind of thrown at you, which, again, that's kind of how they are. They're just like, you're kind of getting sensory bombarded with different themes. You don't know anything about, like, Greek mythology, gonna be lost. You don't know anything about, like, nautical shit, you didn't read Moby Dick, you know, which is basically, you know, 600-page guide to how to be a sailor. You're gonna be lost. You don't have your thesaurus with you, know, like, half these, like, words that are being bandied about, gonna be lost. And you might be annoyed by that, you know? But for me, as for me, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I, you know, I think I gleaned my own thing out of this that I don't think other people would take away from it necessarily.
Yeah, I mean,
for me, I'm on the fence. I don't know if, in my head, if Willem Dafoe's character even exists.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's actually just all in Robert Pattinson's head, and he's just the lone light keeper, and he's going mad.
Mm-hmm.
And descending into alcoholism and his own, you know, demons. Because Willem Dafoe is constantly there talking to him, bouncing back and forth, you know, from being, as you said, nice and then strict. And also gaslighting him constantly throughout the film. Like, one of the best parts is when Willem Dafoe goes out with an axe when the storm's coming and breaks up the lifeboat, and Robert Pattinson's like, "You asshole, why'd you destroy the lifeboat? Now we can't get out of here." And he's like, "You can't abandon your post." And he's like, "Well, why'd you do that?" And he's like, "I didn't do anything. You were the one running around with the axe and destroyed the lifeboat. I'm trying to get help." And then you see Robert Pattinson, like, holding the axe, like, really, really good, you know, really cool and really, you know.
I definitely think that there are elements to this movie that do make you think that, hey, maybe Willem Dafoe's character really doesn't exist, you know, especially the fact that later on the film reveals, like, hey,
that is
Robert Pattinson is not really Ephraim. You know, his name is also Thomas.
What a beautiful name. Why are we naming
Willem
our
Dafoe character? Doesn't think so. He's like, Ephraim.
Why are we naming our children things like this anymore? It's like,
I know.
It's making, you know, it reminds me of the founder of Remington's name, Eliphalet. Eliphalet Remington. Like, why are we bringing, you know, like, nice, like, Greeky sounding names like that back into the public?
That whole idea of Tommy or Thomas and them sharing the same name, it's a little bit too convenient, right, for the realism of the movie. There's obviously something going on there thematically that Robert Eggers wanted to get across. You don't generally have this a character that shares the same name as another character in a movie. Like, that's intentionally one of the things that people try really hard not to do, is, like, don't give them the same fucking names. But in here, we do have the character with the same name, and I think that really speaks to the themes that you're talking about, where potentially Thomas doesn't exist, and it is a Freudian analysis of Thomas himself, and we are seeing Willem Dafoe's character as his id, And we're seeing Robert Pattinson as like the ego representation of him. And perhaps we are supposed to see this as Willem Dafoe's character not truly existing, but being a figment of Robert Pattinson's imagination and hallucination here. I think that there are a kind of like a muddled way of going about that too, though. I guess no one really actually acknowledges Willem Dafoe in this movie, right? Like, we never see the two lighthouse guys. They call them wikis. We never see the wikis that are leaving the lighthouse when they first get there. We don't see them acknowledge Willem Dafoe, right? I don't think, like, they kind of just walk past each other, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, like, I think a valid interpretation is what you think, that it could potentially be Robert Pattinson experiencing his own psyche in human form. Because this Willem Dafoe is like the antagonist throughout the movie. He is like the id. He very much likes to partake in the things that are more of baser value. You know, he is the one that doesn't have a problem with, you know, pissing in front of people, farting all over the place, you know, drinking heavily and encouraging Robert Pattinson's character to drink. So it is like the id in a sense. Is that, you know, like kind of your interpretation that you were going with there?
Yeah. It doesn't even have to be so much Freudian. I mean, it does work, but I mean, I think it's just more, you know, part of his personality, part of who he is, that he's kind of fighting and talking to, because again, he's by himself in the lighthouse. Theoretically, if, you know, right. Willem Dafoe doesn't actually exist and it's just in his head, that's how it kind of works. I mean, like I said, the Freud, as we were talking about, I think, you know, a little bit before that, you know, there's a lot of things here that you can kind of take away from the film, and you can go that route if you want. You don't even have to go that route of, like, you know, delving that deep into it, so.
Right, and you, like we said, you know, you can take it if, at face value of psychological thriller, Robert Pattinson is just going crazy in this lighthouse and probably egged on quite a bit by Willem Dafoe. Or you could take it as, you know, he's experiencing this hallucination. Like you said previously when we were talking, Robert Eggers, he kind of is hinting towards that, because there is that time where Robert Pattinson watches Willem Dafoe smash up the boat with the axe, and then all of a sudden they come back in, and Willem Dafoe is like, "I didn't smash the boat. You smashed the boat." And you kind of have that going on of like, well, you have those unreliable narrators of who is really telling the truth. Can we really trust Willem Dafoe? And the film kind of like holds that in front of you, and just, it doesn't really give you any clues. It's just like, here's two unreliable narrators, and as the viewer, you have to decide.
It's perfect gaslighting on Willem Dafoe's part, constantly making him re-question things. And that's not the only time, too, when he, you know, also when you get to hear Willem Dafoe saying, like, oh, you know, he broke his leg, you know, on a short accident, and that he was with the nuns, and the nuns are taking care of him. And then later on, he's saying he got it from scurvy. You know, damn scurvy, and the whole time Robert Pattinson's like, I thought you said you broke your leg. And he's like, what? Yeah, you misheard me.
Yeah, like it's just a thing that you can mishear accidentally. Like, wait, you told me a whole different story before. No, you misheard it. It's just, yeah.
I think the fact too, also, they don't really, you know, tell, you know, kind of, you know, let each other know who they are until, you know, their names and such. Like, they're together for 4 weeks before, you know, they even, like, reveal, like, their names and stuff when it's the last day before they're supposed to be relieved. And then, you know, that's all turned ass over tea kettle because somebody went and smashed a seagull against a sister, and the winds changed direction, and so did their fortune.
Yeah. And a supernatural element.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's a really interesting idea, pulling in the supernatural element, because The Lighthouse is and isn't a horror movie. You know, it's easy to kind of see it as a horror movie in certain elements because you kind of have expectations when you come into the movie. Robert Eggers' his first movie, this is The Witch, which in itself is kind of and kind of not a horror movie. And then you have the suspensefulness throughout the movie of being presented with these scenes that kind of crop up here and there that are very surprising and very shocking in the way that they're presented. Like you might be going through the film, not really suspecting anything. You know, there's a whole montage sequence of Robert Pattinson just doing shit, fixing up the building, you know, throwing shingles on the roof while smoking a cig. And you kind of like just get this montage of things that are happening that's kind of mundane. And then all of a sudden you get a scene inserted that's just like shocking, or like with the mermaid showing up on the shore and this guy that's drowning in the water, and they kind of come out of nowhere and you get that suspenseful build of the chilling score. And so at that point you're like, oh, it is a horror movie. And then you'll go scene and scene and scene of things that are just more mundane, like Lighthouse stuff and characterization. And then you're like, maybe it's not a horror movie. So the film kind of trades off of that and it has that supernatural element to it, that kind of plays on like Greek mythology, sailor talk, you know, sailor culture of myths and legends and things like that, which I think is really interesting in this movie that you kind of can see it in a lot of different ways. You could see it as a drama. You could see it as youth have called it, a psychological thriller. You can see it as a horror movie if you really think that it's horrific in its portrayals of certain things, like the Poseidon elements, the tentacles and stuff like that. Or sometimes you could see it as a comedy. Like there's that great scene where Robert Pattinson's delivering his soliloquy to Willem Dafoe, and he's drunk and he's voicing all of his concerns. He's like, you know what? You're fucking annoying. You smell bad. You snore.
You smell like piss and onions.
Yeah,
shit.
And jism. And then my favorite part is just when he pulls out the accent and he's like, and you farts! You goddamn farts! it's a great moment, and you kind of have those bits of comedy to it too. That works really well. I mean, it's a great scene. And not only that, but like Willem Dafoe is great too, because he's cantankerous and unlikable at times. And yet there are other scenes where he's funny and, you know, just a pleasurable presence. And I think that's, you know, that's part of the appeal of The Lighthouse, is that just, even though it's set in one location with only two people, you do have the appeal of Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson really leading the charge and being very good character models here for these characters. And as we said, Willem Dafoe is like the perfect person for this role.
Went down to the Gorton's Fish Factory, and
that's, yeah. I know.
He kind of looks like him when he's wearing like he's wearing like the hat, like, you know, like that looks like.
I know. Yeah, he does. But some of the other themes, like that we get in this movie, obviously you have the idea of Greek mythology too, because the film has a lot of Greek elements to it. It has the siren call. You know, in this movie, they kind of treat the mermaid and the siren as the same thing, which I don't know if that's true or not. Mermaid, siren's a little different, but, you know, you have the siren, you have the Prometheus myth that really plays out towards the end of the movie, where Robert Pattinson goes up to the lighthouse after he's murdered Willem Dafoe, and he looks into the light and then falls down the stairs and then gets eaten by birds. He has his organs eaten by birds in that final shot. And so you have that Prometheus myth.
Covered in bird shit, too.
Yeah. And you have the Prometheus myth of Prometheus getting fire and then being punished for it because he wasn't allowed to have it. And so there is that idea of the light being some knowledge or something that should not be harnessed by human eyes, and Robert Pattinson's not worthy of it. And I also see it too as sort of the idea of salvation. So lighthouses are salvation. They're beacons in the mist. And Robert Pattinson was found lacking. He looked into that salvation. He didn't get it.
Which that is terrific too, that how that plays out when he touches, you know, the light and, you know, the sounds basically cut out and you just hear, like, you know, the kind of like echoing noise, and then the face that, you know, he puts on as he's touching it is like maniacal and painful at the same time.
Yeah.
You know?
And the haunting kind of scream that's been reverbed out of control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you could also view that too as like, you know, also like, well, why did he get knocked down the stairs? Was it punishment, or was it just because he went back shit and was touching a fucking light and
burnt, you know? You're right. Just took it a little bit too far.
Yeah, you know.
That's the other myth of flying too close to the sun too, the Icarus myth.
Right.
Yeah. There's a lot of Greekness to it. And then there's also some things that I really didn't know until I kind of looked it up a little bit, like that whole scene where Willem Dafoe is naked and he's peering down at Robert Pattinson. It kind of comes out of nowhere. And there's like a beacon of light coming out of him. And that's apparently, you know, a famous 19th century painting that I really didn't have much knowledge of. That kind of pulls that in too. And, you know, a whole idea about that being used as for gay culture and BDSM culture and things like that is there as well. And so you kind of have all of these ideas kind of muddled together. And I guess if you're going to give one complaint about The Lighthouse, it is that potentially all of those themes and symbols and metaphors don't come together in a way that allows you to draw them all into one concise message or conclusion. There's a lot of disparate elements there, and you can draw a lot of interpretations from them, but it remains fairly ambiguous, you know, on purpose. Of course, Robert Eggers doesn't go at the end of the movie and give you a nice, like, end card that says, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and that's what I meant by it. You know, it's not drawn up into a bow, which I prefer. I would rather make my own interpretation, and I think, you know, while that is a criticism, I actually ended up really enjoying that part of it, that the interpretations can be so unique and different. And as long as you find some through way of like what you're saying, they can be valid, because there's a lot of different ideas at play here that you could draw from. The one that I think is a little bit problematic is the idea that this film is sort of like a gay romance or relationship, because I think that is stretching the idea of what it means to have this like lonely, dominant father son sort of struggle in The Lighthouse. I know a lot of people like to ship characters just because, like, you know, that's a thing that people do now. Is that
I say you've been watching too much anime?
Yeah. Well, like, I feel like that's become even, like, more relevant now. Like, even if in the shows or the movies that you're watching, that's not even really hinted at, like, a romance between the characters, it still seems like lots of fans will crop up in comments and things and be like, I ship these two. It's like, well, but why? Just because you would like to see a romance between them?
They would just not mean great together.
Yeah, it does not mean that that's where the show or the movie intended to go, and I think that's kind of a problem with The Lighthouse. While I think there are definitely themes about masculinity and relationships and loneliness, I don't think this film is inherently a message about being gay and closeted and finding that out in The Lighthouse. It's not, you know, Brokeback Mountain here.
No, because again, like, the whole, you know, being on, you know, basically essentially stranded in that environment for a month with just like one other person that you barely get along with to begin with, before you start turning to booze. That's why I think, too, we consistently, you know, there's more than one, scene where we see, Robert Pattinson rubbing one out.
And actually, I think in the journal that Willem Dafoe keeps, he writes, like, constant,
self-abuse
in the supply shed or something like that. Which, we don't see that often, but...
I would say, which we forgot, we were trying, what the fuck was he saying for that? Yeah. And I was looking it up when we were recording, and I'm like, what the hell is it? Because trying to be mad, and I looked up, old-timey words for beating off.
So obvious. Yeah, no. This film has probably all the bodily fluids, right? It's got...
Jism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, jism, shit,
puke. Fart. Don't you love when Robert Pattinson goes to empty the chamber pots and he goes to throw him over the cliff and the fucking wind just blows him?
Lets out a primal scream.
Yeah, I would too. And it's green, comes back, lighthouse, and Willem Dafoe's like, you smell like shit.
Yeah. Get this cleaned up in here. Yeah. I feel like you can kind of see those elements at play. But it's more about sexuality in general. It's more about the loneliness of being in this this place. And we don't actually know how long they really truly are there. Because time in this place is also suspect. Yeah. We don't know. And the unreliability of the characters means that we just will never know how much time passed. Was it truly 4 weeks and whatever, however long it took after the storm, or was Willem Dafoe lying and it really wasn't as much time? No one knows from the actual narrative, but it's about the loneliness of the situation and being stuck in this environment. And then also, too, ideas about dominance, masculinity, obviously, the lighthouse itself is a very phallic symbol. And not only that, but it's imposing and living, too. The lighthouse is constantly a living being. We see it constantly changing, getting shingles. The storm blows the windows in, and then there's, a whole swampiness to it. It is in itself a living being. And then you also have the idea of dominance over, this siren, too. Because there's a whole scene where they're having sex and you see her truck badge.
Well, that's not even dominance. That's, him submitting. Cause, that's the whole kind of, bit of the siren, which is, I can't remember if we brought it up earlier or not, but.
Yep.
About, they're out to sea for 7 months. Oh, there's land. Oh, there's something with boobies out there.
Yeah.
It's calling me, and just
whatever it is.
Oh, it's a fish. It's a fish with tits, but, any port in a storm.
And you also have that whole scene where Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe get drunk, and then eventually, they get to a point where they're, really pissed off at each other, and then... They basically say, Robert Pattinson says he wants a steak and
Bloody Rare.
Bloody Rare. And Willem Dafoe is like, you don't like my cooking?
It's so great because he's just like Klaus from Life Aquatic. You don't like my cooking? And he's like, I don't want a fucking steak. I have that rare steak. I'm going to fuck it. But you love my lobster rolls. My lobster.
It's
true.
That's an interesting moment, too, because we don't really see that kind of vulnerability, especially from Willem Dafoe's character throughout the movie until he's kind of in a drunken state. And, it's an interesting shift for that character to see them in sort of a home-style sort of fashion there. So it's all very interesting, but I don't think that we can, draw conclusions that it's meant to be them being gay. because I think that's actually detrimental to a reading of the movie. I think there's more to it than just they want a gay relationship and they're too afraid to explore it.
Film definitely leaves, at least for us, definitely the fact that it's so open-ended thematically and with kind of what's presented to you. It does definitely, I rarely find myself wanting to rewatch films, and this one's kind of, one that I'd put in, like, oh, I would consider easily, like, sitting down again real soon and rewatching this to see, look out, now that I know what happens, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that, like, happen very quickly and on purpose. Robert Eggers kind of hides those things happening. Like, as you mentioned, you texted me and you're like, was that Robert Pattinson beaten off? Like, at the beginning, that first part of the film? Because it's so quick and it's not really apparent, like, what's happening at first.
Because it's dark and you can't see anything. And while you just hear,
Yeah. And then great sound design. Thanks, Foley guy. Foley guy went out and got a hot dog with a bagel.
No, he went authentic. He's like, I didn't need you to whip your dick out and stuff.
The authentic sound design in this one. Very realistic.
We'll get you a lobster shell. Just pretend it's a fleshlight and...
One thing that we didn't talk about is the foghorn that is perpetually around throughout the movie. Foghorn is just there.
Our nice Hans Zimmer cue that's ever present.
The foghorn is like...
awesome.
It is a great moment for every time the foghorn comes up. You have this foghorn that just constantly sounds in the background, and a lot of times it's hard to tell too if it's really diegetic and actually happening in the movie, or if it's just part of the soundtrack too, because the soundtrack kind of works in a sort of foghorn sound during its droning too. So you have like the idea that, like, is it really happening? Is everyone hearing it? Is Robert Pattinson the only one really hearing it? Because we see sometimes he's very bothered by it. Especially like when he's working in the furnace area and he's shoveling like coal into the furnace, the foghorn keeps going off. He's like, oh, it's not clear if everyone's hearing it, if it's just him's hearing it. And it is a very, it adds to the tension because you just have that kind of blaring in the background.
It's omnipresent. I love it. Just constantly, and it with the flow of the film. It, raises and lowers. Like, there's times where it's just kind of muted in the background. You hear it, just... But as, things start to kind of escalate, it goes with the tension.
And yeah.
It's like... it's like a nice cue. Like, it's like the light itself. It's like, it's like, a call out to the sea. It's like, the siren's called, not sounding like the siren, but, droning, ever-present, trying to lure you in. And I love it. It's great. It's one of the best parts of the film. And how he utilized it is nothing short of great.
And like you said, outside of the podcast, it would have been interesting to see this movie in theaters, because that would have been kind of like a nice...
Imagine that on like a nice IMAX.
Yeah.
You get that nice actual surround sound compared to our theater with a punched out sound design, get that full effect. That'd be, that would be awesome.
Anything else that we didn't touch on that you wanted to talk about?
So what did you think? We didn't touch upon the thing that caused everything to go tits up. We vaguely touched upon it, but... So what do you think of, the whole seagull myth? Because that is, an old sailor's tale that, seagulls house the souls of dead sailors. Kind of like how, it's bad to kill a crow and eat a crow because they house of souls of people too.
What do you think of that? And then how, like, you know, how that was kind of utilized and that idea and why Robert Pattinson was just a blatant asshole to the bird.
Well, him bashing it is a good scene. Just going, you know, he's tried to put up with it. And then all of a sudden he's just like, this fucking seagull, leave me the fuck alone. And he just starts smashing it on the side of the cistern. It's a great moment of rage. And like, from a supernatural perspective, like, I don't know that we're meant to really see in this movie, like, oh yeah, that's the, that's truly what made everything go wrong, is like the seagull being smashed in the superstition of killing a gull. However, the film is, you know, often couched in superstition. You know, it has almost like sort of like an old ones style thing with Lovecraft at times.
Because even Willem Dafoe is, you know, very, like, he saw, like, I saw you, you know, hitting that door. Don't fucking do that. Or, you know, it'd be bad omens. And that,
right.
You know.
And I think it kind of leaves that, it kind of calls attention to the fact that superstitions came from people intentionally creating these stories because they wanted to dispel certain things in society, right? They wanted to stop people from doing certain things. This is kind of like the way that we tell ghost stories or monster stories to kids as well, where we want them to not do something. So we use the monster as sort of the reason why you don't do it, right? Don't go by the lake because there's a monster in the lake that's going to get you and come out from the ocean and grab you on the beach. Instead of saying, hey, this wave is going to come and fucking pull you out to sea, we use a monster instead.
It's going to be Swamp Thing instead.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that kind of happens in The Lighthouse too, because depending on your interpretation of the movie, like, that superstitious element sets things into play because it does make Willem Dafoe dislike Robert Pattinson even more, right? So he sees him smashing a gull, and he's like, I fucking told you, don't kill a gull because it's bad luck. And so now Willem Dafoe kind of piles on even harder of the shit that he was doing to Robert Pattinson. So you can say, like, well, no, it wasn't really the superstition that caused this issue, but the fact that he did it caused someone else to get angry and set the whole thing in motion. You could see it that way. Which is kind of like how I see it, is like, people's superstitions actually sometimes cause the problem that they were thinking they wanted to avoid because of the superstition. Like, the same with breaking a mirror. Oh shit, I broke a mirror, I'm gonna have 7 years bad luck. And then everything that happens to you that's bad, like, oh, it's always me, it's because of that bad luck I broke that mirror. It's like, everybody has bad luck at some point, right? Like, everybody stubs their toe on the side of the wall one time in the dark. It's not because you broke a mirror, it's because that's what happens. You live your life and things happen to you in your life because you're the one living it. But you tend, like, after you believe in superstitions, you tend to believe that everything that happens after is because of the superstition. I think that's kind of like what happens in The Lighthouse. I don't really take it as a true thing, supernatural thing that happens because he killed that gull. But at the same time, the gull reappearing at the end of the film and kind of making that point is symbolic of the fact that, like, that was a turning point for Robert Pattinson. That was kind of where he went off the rails. And it kind of has that, like, symbolic meaning to it. That's my interpretation. What about yours?
No, I agree. And if anything, that kind of, I think kind of one of the things that, you know, pokes kind of the hole in my head of, like, of Willem Dafoe being, you know, part of Robert Pattinson's personality and such is the fact that Willem Dafoe is this well-read, well, not well-read, but, you know, hard-boiled, hardened, you know, sailor with all this, you know, Greek mythology and stuff like that. Like, Robert Pattinson, you know, would have no reason to kind of be able to know that kind of crap unless he up in Canada when he was on the lumber mill trail letting people get swallowed up by the logs. Now, like, he was also up there learning about Oh, yeah, did you know it's the seagulls or lost souls of sailors who died?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that Robert Pattinson's character is pretty well read.
He better be with a name like Ephraim.
Yeah. So, I mean, potentially that would be some knowledge that he might have. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, there is holes in that theory of would this all be common knowledge that he would have? Maybe not.
Well, maybe because he's from Maine, that's why.
Yeah. Sure.
But, yeah, no, I definitely like that aspect because it kind of, like, gives an omen to set everything, you know, in motion of, like, what happens in the third act. Ties it all together, you know, especially because the siren itself that, you know, kind of lures him out to sea and, you know, when he first hears it and sees her, you know, he's not even mesmerized, but he's, you know, entranced and scared by it. And, but he keeps being drawn back out to this, you know, to the sea to find her throughout his time in the lighthouse. And, the seagull itself kind of tie all, you know, that whole Proteus mythology all together to give him, like, a reason to want to go up into the lighthouse and, you know, do what he's doing. So they're all neat little things that, you know, are uniquely put together that all tie together. Like, because nothing's really greater than the other in that piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's ambiguous and intentionally so. And I think you are free to make pretty much any interpretation that you want as long as, again, like I said, it's, as long as it's couched in things that the film actually gives you, you're free to make an interpretation and it can be valid. And I think that, like, that's what I like about The Lighthouse, that there are some movies where it's ambiguous and you really can't make an interpretation. It's so ambiguous that you're like, I really don't know. You know, I don't really know what they meant by that because there's just so much thrown at you and you can't put it together. With The Lighthouse, you can put it together, and you can put it together in a multitude of ways. And I think that's a pretty cool thing. All right, so on a scale of 0 to 10 mystery fluids dripping down from the beacon.
Chism.
Yeah. What would you give The Lighthouse?
I'll give it a 9 out of 10. I was overwhelmingly surprised with how much I liked this film. Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson, absolutely fantastic, totally terrific. The film is, you know, a brilliant little character study of two people. The setting is awesome. You know, it's small and quaint with the, yeah, well, not quaint, but the setting's small. You know, it's very claustrophobic, even with, like, the exteriors, too. Everything kind of, you know, works beautifully together. You know, the black and white does do a lot for the film and gives it a nice, you know, classic, dated, adds kind of a little bit to the terror. The, you know, sound in this is great. It's, you know, we're talking about, like, the foghorn drone. It's, you know, really great. Film has a lot of different themes in it. And I think the fact that it's open-ended and ambiguous and not really interested in trying to come to a conclusion, but kind of let you sit and ponder it, it's nice because I think it's, you know, one of the few films that it does that really well. Like, you know, you're not left feeling cheated out of that because you kind of can run into that sometimes when an artist is being obtuse. But the main reason to watch this film is, you know, Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. They're absolutely terrific. Robert Eggers does a terrific job directing this. This is, you know, one of the best films I've probably seen in the past, like, 5 years. 9 out of 10. This is, you know, I can't recommend it, you know, strongly enough. It's at an hour and 40. It's a pretty, you know, 40
hour, minutes. Hour and 50, yeah.
Yeah, it's tight. The film's tight and it's well-paced and, you know, it's metered out really well. So if you, you know, haven't seen it yet and you've heard like the hype, I would definitely say check it out. But it's definitely a film that, you know, you're not going to have a middle ground with. You're either going to love it for what it is and what Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson bring to you, or you're going to be, if you're going to be pissed off and being like, what the fuck did I just watch? So yeah, I'd say 9 out of 10. I love this film. That was really good.
Yeah, I would agree. I would give it a 9 out of 10 as well. It's a really good film. I was extremely surprised. I actually, when I sat down to watch it, it was later at night, and I was like, you know, I might only make it through like half of this movie tonight, and then I'll watch the rest tomorrow. And I just sat there engrossed in the movie, and it just flew by. By the time I had finished, I was like, holy shit, I just watched the whole thing. Didn't even need to. It is a really engrossing movie, despite the fact that it only has two characters for the most part and one setting. You would expect that to be really lackluster, or, you know, at least like kind of striving to hit the hour and 50 mark and kind of falling short. But for me, it does not. It manages it all very well, and that's really due to both Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe's portrayals of their characters. They do an excellent job, and they just are constantly grabbing your attention. And then not only that, but Robert Eggers' direction as well is constantly grabbing your attention, whether it be the excellent score, like that overwhelming score, the idea of the lighthouse as being like this being almost, and constantly changing, or the amount of different themes and scenes that are sneak in to the movie that you're not even really expecting, and then all of a sudden they're just boom right in front of you. All of that just like keeps you wanting more as you keep watching. And even though it does end, it doesn't really give you a specific interpretation or how you're supposed to come away from the movie. I think that's one of its strong suits, because it doesn't need to give you a specific meaning. You can derive the meaning from a lot of different symbolism of the movie, and you really don't need it to tell you what to think. You just need to think about it yourself and kind of try and figure out how you see it and interpret the movie, because there's a variety of ways that you can. Many of them are valid, and however you see the movie is kind of like a uniqueness to you, because we can come away with completely different views of the film and still potentially be correct, because there really is no like cemented meaning to it. So I really like that. I think the horror element does come out at times, and it does have a very suspenseful pacing to it. And overall, very impressed with this movie. Kind of sad I waited 4 years to see it, and kind of waited on it. And, you know, it's just something I recommend that everybody should see at least once, and it give it a shot to see what you think about it. Because I think people go into it thinking like it's going to be like some art house movie, and it, you know, it kind of is at times, but at the same time, I think it's really engaging for a common audience too. So really, really happy that we picked that one.
Really happy you picked that.
Yeah.
Some inspiration.
Sure. So what do we want to do next time?
Well, I mean, do we want to do it? I think we just have to do it though.
What's that?
The new Evil Dead.
Sure. I actually do want to do it. Let's see. What? Just want to check the date.
Not that I don't want to do it, but that's like one of the things I hate about when it comes to shit like this. We're like practically, you know, when the new stuff comes out, like you have to do it. Like,
sure. Yeah. No. I mean, yeah, that would be right in line of when we need to do our next episode. So I think that's probably what we'll end up doing. I'm excited for it. I've heard really good things about it. From the trailers and everything that I've seen, it actually does look very solid. So I'm excited to see what this brings to the table.
Not seeing any Bruce Campbell, and I'm not seeing any Lucy Lawless. This is frying.
Darn. Well, Bruce Campbell did say that he would be back in if Sam Raimi did one.
Sam Raimi's too busy making Doctor Strange movies now.
I don't know.
Or that not make enough for him to get a second shot at it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he'll do the next one or not. It would be nice to have him move back to the horror genre, but yeah, I'm hoping that it comes to theaters around us, though. I think it will. I imagine it will. I wouldn't see why not, but
it's not like the. I was gonna say it's not like we're getting a cavalcade of films coming out right now.
Yeah, and unfortunately, all of the schedules don't go out that far, so it's I can't check, but I assume that we'll be getting it by us. So, yeah, Evil Dead Rise, you'll want to check that out.
I can't believe it's been 10 years since the fucking
the remake.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I couldn't believe it'd been 4 years since the Lighthouse released. So.
Yeah, our friend who watched it today was saying, like, I can't believe I beat you to it.
I know. I know. All right, so if you want to hear our episode on Evil Dead Rise, then you should subscribe to us, especially if you enjoyed this episode. We're on pretty much any podcasting app you can think of, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, our home base at anchor.fm, /Spotify. Spotify bought it, so it's Spotify now. Subscribe to there, leave us a nice review. Appreciate that. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for us, Blood and Black Rum Podcast. Like us, follow us, whatever you do on there. We also have an email address at bloodandblackrumpodcast@gmail.com. Write to us, let us know what you like, what you don't like, what movies you want to hear us cover, and we'll take that into consideration. And then finally, you can donate to us. We have a Patreon page. You can donate to us on our Spotify account there on anchor.fm. Anything you can leave us is great, and we'll put it back towards beer and movie tickets, apparently. So, thanks a lot for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode on The Lighthouse, and hope you have seen The Lighthouse and loved it, or check it out at some point. And until next time when we do Evil Dead Rise,
take care.